think it is or is not, in terms of lyrics, performance, musical form. I don't know if you're qualified to answer all that.
Well, I'm certainly not qualified to answer anything about musical
me
form.
Me neither.
Yeah, okay. Teresa is, I guess.
I can set up another mic.
Well, let's see what we can do with that.
Okay. Well, okay, lyrically, I think what we said before about how it should not be anything that's oppressive to women, I also think that women's music can go beyond that and should go beyond that. I don't think that I think that there should be some political content to lyrics, which does not necessarily mean, I mean, I think that most women's music has political content, even if it's about there's this woman that I love, or there's this woman that I like, that is so unheard of in the record industry, that, you know, women liking women, that is in itself a political statement, or I am a strong woman is a political statement. I think also, and I think that that kind of stuff is sufficient, but I think that there is also a need for more, I don't know what word to use, for other kinds of music that speak to specific issues that affect women, that propose solutions, even if they are, let's all get together, or even if they are, you know, here are these questions, let's find the answers. I think that musicians have a responsibility to at least raise questions, the same way that we all do, and that the music has to do that, the same way that all of our work has to do that. In terms of performance, do you want to say anything else about lyrics? Performance, I think it's real important that the barriers, the traditional barriers between the audience and the performer be done away with as much as possible. That concerts be seen as, I mean, there's no way that there's going to be any kind of like total equality between musician and audience. The audience has come to hear the musician, and the musician is there to perform for the audience, and that exists, and it's not like the audience, you know, I don't know. There are some people who think that concerts shouldn't happen because that sets up a power situation. Well, I think it does set up a power situation, but I think that it's the kind of situation where if it's done right, and if it's done with the knowledge of what's going on, that it's okay. It's like when I take my car to the mechanic, I'm giving her power, which I willingly give her, and she does something with that power, and then I have my car. And when I go to a concert, I'm giving the musician some power, and if she uses it right and gives me power back because of her music, gives me energy, gives me support, makes me think, makes me feel things, then that's, to me, is a good use of power, and I'm willing to do that. But I think that, you know, false power or star tripping is a whole other story, and I think that is a real drag. What that means in reality is ticket prices have to be reasonable. A person shouldn't get $6 because she can for a concert. People should get what they need, and people should pay what they can pay, which is a whole other discussion. I think that you know, if the musician is doing the kind of music that will reflect the lives of the women in the audience, that's the kind of sharing that's real important that has to happen, whereas if she's up there singing about, you know, her villa in the mountains or her boyfriend or something like that, that doesn't encourage a lot of audience participation. I don't know, what else do you think?
Well, I was starting to think more in terms of performance. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. But then I was the producer. I was getting into production, so it doesn't matter.
You have that in the brain.
Yes.
You
want to
get into it?
Well, I could talk about production in that it's becoming more and more of a priority to us to make the cultural events, the concert, also a place to organize energy that is created by that cultural event, so that you don't have women who just sort of almost consider themselves feminists because they go to women's concerts. Okay? That a concert is a place that creates a lot of tremendous energy and good feeling and sort of inspiration and stuff. And that we feel more and more that that should be directed in some way, or at least women should be given some kind of opportunity to explore political involvement as a result of that new energy that they feel. And we here, and other performers too, and producers around the country, certainly, you know, Olivia does not have any kind of... A lot of people are talking about this, particularly women's productions company around the... production companies around the country and performers are talking about really making a lot of use of those situations so that a woman does have a list of places that she could go to contact people, that she does not feel that she's an outie in an Inzies group when she's there, that she has as much opportunity as everyone else to become involved, and that her energy is needed. And so that, all right, specifically on the back of your flyer, your program or something, the Women's Prison Coalition needs 25 people next weekend to lick envelopes. Okay, that's the beginning. That woman can plug in there.
The other thing I want to say about performances is that I think everybody has to remember, and I say remember because it seems like a lot of people forget, that musicians or performers are just regular women, you know, who have this skill, which is that they make music, and they do it in a public way, and that focuses a lot of attention on them. As a skill, it's a very powerful skill, and it can affect a lot of people, but it's no more inherently or intrinsically valuable than the skill of a woman who fixes cars, or a woman who grows food for other women, or a woman who writes books, or any of those other skills that we all need. What makes the performer different is that she does her thing in public for lots of people. And what is important is that both the performer and the women's community remember that. Do not give her power beyond what happens, you know, beyond the power that we give to people with skills, which is to use their skills for us. And if performers do that, and if audiences do that, then there shouldn't be problems of star tripping by audiences, and there shouldn't be problems of performers acting like stars. They're just regular women, you know, and they have certain needs that vary among them, that, you know, that some people may interpret as star needs. Like, I know that Meg needs to be alone before a concert for an hour or so to warm up her fingers, to get her head together. Some people say, well, that's star tripping, she has to be off in her dressing room. That's not star tripping, that's getting herself together to do her job. And people, you know, that it comes from both places, because there surely are performers who get into the power that they have and abuse it. And there surely are women who come to concerts and lay all kinds of trips on performers to solve all their problems or to be their ideal woman or something. And they're not ideal women, you know. They go to the bathroom. They pick their noses.
They do not.
I have seen them. I have seen Teresa pick her nose.
One other thing that I think should be said about the whole thing about women's music. Like, we have this tape library, and we ask women all over the country to send us tapes of their music. And we recently constructed a questionnaire, mainly because we want the tape library to be accessible, so it sort of needs to be organized and cataloged. And also because we want women to be defining their own music, so that there's a place on the questionnaire, as alienating as the questionnaire might be. We felt it was real necessary to say, okay, women's music is something that is not easily categorizable, and we are not willing to make the categories for it. You define your own music, and the way you do that maybe is how do you see your music? What do you want to do with your music? What would you like other people to be able to do with your music? That kind of a focus to it. And so women are able to define it, you know, themselves. Another thing I think that should be said specifically is that most of the music which is being called women's music specifically right now, most of it that's getting a lot of exposure is music that is coming from white women. A lot of them are middle class. We haven't, in terms of exposure of women's music, we haven't touched the surface of what there is. And that's another thing that we feel a real strong commitment to change.
Generally, in terms of the concert situation, there are a lot of things I have ideas about and a lot of things I'm sort of in the process of developing, or I imagine Olivia's in the process of developing, that have a lot to do with the power situation around performing. For instance, there's sort of two power dynamics going on. There's the fact that the audience has all come here to see this performer, and there's the fact that a performer is up here vulnerable to, you know, lots of times what happens is a performer will say, I'm a feminist performer, I'm a lesbian feminist performer, and people take their stipulative definitions, you know, and say, well, this is what you should be giving to me. I think real important things to do are, for instance, to break down these kind of relationships, like, are things like accessibility, you know, like how accessible is a musician to the people. It's important that things happen during the concert, too, you know, that break it down. For instance, I think it's really important for a performer to say how explicitly she is accessible. For you know, it's not reasonable that people want to shout their criticisms up from the audience, or that a performer after the performance is so wiped out that it's not conceivable that right then and there everyone can come up and give their feedback. But there need to be structures to allow for feedback and for criticism and for just talking about music. I think another good idea is to, rather than have a single performer, to have a lot of different performers, to reach out to, say, local performers, if you're performing in an area, to a real important thing is to have different kinds of music available in a performance in order to draw, you know, a whole span of people that normally wouldn't be drawn, which is part of what Olivia is doing now, like the new album, Bibi Kuroshe, is going to appeal to a whole lot of women that, say, Meg and Chris haven't appealed to and won't begin to until, you know, there's a whole new span of music. So, also, there needs to be audience participation during the concert, you know, like something, you just need a real consciousness on the part of the performer and on part of the whole structure of the performance to break down these things, you know, like to use more performers, to vary the music, to use audience participation, to be willing to communicate while you're there. Like, part of people knowing what you're about is you telling them, you know, like being able to just to relate people from, well, here I am, I ate a bologna sandwich today, you know, anything that, really. I have a lot of questions about sizes of concerts, too. Like, that has a lot to do with it. Whether it is more feasible to have large concerts drawing the money that you want and the people that you want, or to for a performer to work harder and just to keep concerts small, like, so that you can relate to them in some kind of human way rather than being part of a, you know, part of a herd. So, I don't know. Those are my thoughts in terms of concert production. I don't know what other kind of stuff you want to know.
There's several women who believe there is a difference in the musical form produced by women who are consciously trying to do that. I don't know if you put any thought into that or how you feel about it.
Well, generally, in a concept of women's music, I've thought of in music today, there's a lot of, God, I don't know how you'd say it, male manifestation. You know, just ways of your music appealing to people. Like whether you drive it into their brains with hard-going music, or whether you, I do really on one hand, although it's hard to generalize women's music. I think women's music is, it's hard to find the word for it too. Maybe a lot more tactful, less oppressive. I mean, it's not music that beats you over the head to listen. And that's not just talking about volume. They're all kind. I think women's music has the potential to be incredibly, like, have an incredible amount of variety, but in the same sense, I really do think there is a physical difference. You know, there is. Relating from a position of less power, you know, not using power in your music. I mean, that's a thing that happens a lot with women musicians, that, you know, this that's inherent, you know. Do you understand what I mean?
I understand, yeah. Can you talk about how that happens? How does that manifest?
Well, for instance, as a performer, it's taken me years and years and years to be comfortable performing, and I'm still not comfortable performing. I'm really not comfortable performing. I'm comfortable maybe once I get there, and I'm comfortable in front of women audiences. But I've so many times have gone to performances like years ago where men will come on the stage, and they could have the skill of a toad, and they'll come onto stage totally confident, totally overbearing, totally, my life is your life, enjoy it, you know.
Vulnerability, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, accountability, vulnerability, coming from just a place, a harder place. I mean, it's just inherent that these things are going to come up in the music.
There's one thing that I've noticed as, mostly as we've made albums, and that is that when a lot of musicians are working on, a lot of women musicians are working on something, they are much less competitive in the making of their music than the kind of things you hear on men's records. And that's been true for, well, it certainly, I think, is evident in, like, the B.B. Kerosh album, which is where, you know, they are a band. And I think it's also evident on the other albums. You just don't hear the musicians fighting each other to have their little lick blared out at the expense of everybody else's little lick, or filling up every space that's available with some other little fancy doodad that somebody could fill in that wouldn't make much sense in the context of the whole song, you know, but would sure would show off somebody's guitar playing or something, you know. I guess I think that's...
Is there anything you can say about how that comes across the music album? I really don't know how to explain it because I'm not a music major, but in use of, let's say, suspensions, pedal tones, the chords you choose.
You're talking to a non-technically learned musician, but I don't know if I necessarily believe that it's in terms of, for instance, I mean, open chords, minor chords, things like that. I would hope that there aren't patterns like that set up in women's music, because then again, you're going to be appealing to a certain strain of people. I think it's really, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of music that come from different cultures and different backgrounds that certainly aren't going to have those type of things. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be possible to say that that there's a pattern in women's music now, but I think Olivia, for instance, is really trying to change that. I think it's really important that it be changed, because now the women's music movement is like sort of just open to certain types of people, certain types of privileged people, and it's possible that music patterns can develop from that, but hopefully they'll expand.
Good, thank you.
Okay.
Well, there was one line that
in the whole album
that I think there's only one line that was changed. That was in Kalua Mama. It was a line that was, I'm going to wrap you in a hula skirt and shake that thing, and that was changed on the grounds that it was racist and sexist to the brilliant line, I want to move with you and groove with you.
Yeah.
Shake that thing.
That's the only thing that had to be changed.
Uh-huh.
How did you deal with that? I mean, or was it just saying, hey, we don't?
It was basically saying, this line is racist and sexist, and they said, oh, yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah, the band was, I mean, totally involved in it. I mean, it's not like they were sort of pushed up against the wall by the record company or something like that. I mean, they certainly didn't want anything like that any more than anyone else did, so.
By the way, kick me out when you have to go back to work,
okay? What time is that?
12:30.
How much more do you have?
Well, I can go into
six volumes.
How different that was in doing like one female performer in a band, and then also I didn't get on tape some of your plans for the future.
Well, Bibi Karosh was real. It was a real different experience. I wasn't in the studio all of the time, but just to say a few words about the difference is that this is a group of women that has worked together for a long time, and they have a lot of process that they do together. And it was a real wonderful kind of thing to watch them not only plan the album but plan things around the album or something. For example, one of the great decisions of all times, I think, was that ordinarily the writer of a song gets mechanicals, which are certain royalties that are paid to the writer of a song automatically, almost always automatically. And it was their feeling, for example, that although most of the songs were almost all but one of the songs was written by Virginia Rubino, that as a collective they had worked on these for a long time, and that each woman had made it her own or something like that. So they waived royalties that just went to Virginia, and they will share those and stuff. So it was real different in terms of process and the kind of, it wasn't like Olivia meeting with one woman, but these two collectives that would, you know, balance each other out. In the studio, they were trying to operate collectively, although they had a producer, which was real important because it would have been real hard for us. But certainly the process was different, and as usual bore out our contention that women working together is wonderful. I don't know if you want to say more about that. And see, we also didn't know about working with a band. Like, we thought it was going to be real quick or something. We thought it would be a lot quicker because there wouldn't be so many overdubs or something. Well, it wasn't. And that was, I mean, it was that many more things to contend with, and no one knew that was going to happen, and that was a big revelation. So, do you have anything further to say about it?
No.
The album is incredible. The album is just hot and wonderful and sexy and really and truly great, and it's we're real proud of it and of the way it was done.
And it comes out in October.
Yeah.
A baby is born.
Right.
Well, that's what it feels like every time.
Right.
Not that I've ever had a baby, but.
Right. We'll be releasing also at the same time a poetry album by Judy Gron and Pat Parker.
Right.
Wow.
Which is, it's a wonderful album. If I don't know if a lot of women have heard either of them read. They are excellent readers, and they both have, well, Pat has some new stuff on her side, some brand new stuff that has never been published or read before, and Judy has a lot of the She Who poems on her side, which were written to be read and have not been published, and as well as some of the Common Woman and some other stuff, and it's a really wonderful album. Also in the fall we will be distributing the Berkeley Women's Music Collective album, which is real exciting to be distributing that. And we will be distributing Cassie Culver's album.
Which is the second project of Wise Women Enterprises that did Kay Gardner's. Yes.
Right.
Right.
The Berkeley Women did their own record on their own and we're distributing it. So we are going to have a very busy fall. Also, we're going to have out a songbook of Chris's album in the fall. And that's a lot of things to have.
Are you going to be doing Willie Tyson's album too when that comes out?
I don't know. We haven't talked to her at all about that. A lot will depend on what she does with it. I mean, on her first album, she had male musicians, and if she does that again, we won't distribute it. And if she does, then I'm sure we will want to talk to her about it.
In the middle of October, Teresa goes into the studio. Teresa Troll, she's from North Carolina, and she's going to have a real... well, again, we always expect them to be wonderful, and they always are.
They are. The interesting thing about Teresa's album is that, or one of the interesting things, I'm sure there are many interesting things, but we first heard Teresa's music because she sent us a tape to the tape library, which proves that we listen to the tapes and that the tape library works, which is just exciting when you actually set up something in order to do something and it works.
Right.
You set up a tape library to hear women's music and you hear it and there's somebody that you instantly go crazy about and want to record.
Meg's taken songs from what's coming on the library too, right?
Right.
Chris Danny Bitterman.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And she really tries to do that as a priority so that other women's music is heard. And then, so, then, in the late winter or early spring, we will be recording Linda Tillery, who is the woman who produced the B.B. Kerosh album and who also is producing Teresa's album. And she will be doing her own album then in, I think, March.
Right.
We'll be going in with her. And... Jenny said before, we're looking for a Latin band. That's true. We are looking for a Latin band. We're looking for, particularly, we're looking for third world women to be recording. And then we would like to record Meg again. We would hope to be able to do that sometime next summer.
I was about to the question of once you've gotten one album out, do you have to wait till everybody else gets taken care of?
Well, in a sense, that's true. We have felt very strongly that as little access that everyone has to recording, that it's real weird to record someone twice before everyone has a chance. On the other hand, it's obviously a little unrealistic to wait till everyone has a chance. So what we're hoping is that by the time it's time to record Meg again, that we will... Well, one of the things I think of is that... perhaps by that time we will have a studio so that we'll be more in a position to be doing more recording in general. and it will make more sense at that point.
Are the albums coming out of what, still coming in donations, or are you beginning to be able to do the next album from the sales of the past album?
Oh, we're definitely beginning to be able to do that. What we're not beginning to be able to do is buy a studio as a result of what's coming in. But we are certainly, making our money back in enough time that we can. Another thing that's real exciting that women should know, I think, or it's which is real exciting to me, is that we are starting to pay salaries, and that that is a long time coming. We have, the five of us who were originally involved, were not paid. We operated off of savings and other unemployment and
Meg's
concerts and whatever we could scrounge around and get, and we never did take any money out of Olivia. Well, we're now, the five of us are on a very small salary. I guess you would call it a nominal salary, $100 a month. But, right, we are able to do that because we have a living collective which is separate, in which we put up, the money goes into a pot. And so, a large pot. Anyway, but we are paying three other people. Why are you saying Because you didn't get mentioned as a earner? Oh, well, I thought you said
No, nothing.
Okay, we're also paying three other people, and we're paying them, what we've always said is we'd like to pay according to need. And so what we are actually doing is doing that. And the way that we figured that, which again, this may not be able to be continued for time indefinite because it's a little sometimes hard to determine, but we asked those women to add up all what they considered their needs, which is not their minimal needs, but their needs to have a sort of, not lavish, a sort of modest life.
Right.
And we paid them that, which means that it was not connected to what they were doing in the company or or you know, weighing musicianship or connection with music to typing. It was just weighed with their need, and that is happening. I feel real wonderful about that because it's also, if you're really trying to create an organization that's going to be strong, it seems to be realistic to pay salaries.
Right. There's actually four women now that are on full-time salaries, and I guess they range from about $350 a month to about $550 a month. And the little extra is for what if you have to go to the doctor?
Tires on the car,
things like that. So it's not just what you eat and your rent every month. It's realizing that people have to live, plus a little spending money for your vices, whatever they may be.
How's the name Olivia come up?
I wish we would come up with a better story than the truth.
We could certainly make one up.
Yeah, the truth is kind of boring.
Well, it was just, I don't know if you've ever been involved in a discussion of trying to name something,
yeah.
But, I mean, it's just so crazy. But, so we finally got to the point where we were talking about, well, let's just explore women's names after we'd been through the mythology books 20 times and all that kind of stuff. And at the time, someone was familiar with or reading or had just heard of this little novelette about a schoolgirl that falls in love with her teacher, I believe. And it was, the name of it was Olivia, and it was written by a woman named Olivia, and so, and it's a musical name.
Sounds good, right? Beats Mary Jane Records.
Right. So, it ain't thrilling, but it's, you know, that's the truth.
And it's round, you know, which is good.
Right.
Olivia.
Right.
Anything you want to end it up with?
One thing that we have not even touched upon, which is real important to us, is the distribution system,
mm-hmm.
which we have. And that consists of, at this point, around 60 to 70 women. We're in a transition point, and that's why I say 60 to 70. Some may be leaving us as a result of a new system that we're working out. But quite a few women who, they are salespersons in their own communities. They are more than that for us. They are almost like a communications network as well, to stay in touch with various communities around the country. They are like a political representative of Olivia in their own community. It's a network that we're creating that we're real committed to on all those different levels. And they are really the lifeblood of what is happening here because they are the ones who are marching around to radio stations trying to get airplay, which is real hard for somebody like us. They are the ones who line up their friends on Saturday afternoon to go into record stores and ask if they have our records, which is the kind of ingenious plot that they have to devise to get our records into places. They are the ones who are trying to hold workshops and explain to people why we took an ad in Rolling Stone, if we took an ad in Rolling Stone, which we didn't. But I wish we could afford an ad. But they are really, becoming the real happening of Olivia at this point.
They are also the ones who say, I mean, when our Chico distributor wrote and said, there is this problem with Tower Records and Chico, which is that they are firing lesbians. I mean, that's real important to us, for them to say that, and for us, you know, for them to communicate to us what's going on in their community, so that, because we don't know.
You don't know about
Jesus? No, we don't. We hardly even know about L.A.
What if they're coming from a political ideology totally alien to you, how do you deal with that?
Well, that's sort of, I don't know that we haven't run into that many women who have been into politics that were totally alien to us.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, we were making these agreements with women, and maybe we really didn't know who they were or anything about their politics. So since then, we've at least tried to make sure that before we make this agreement with any woman, the way we devised to find out her politics and whether we could work together or we should be working together was by telling her ours.
Mm-hmm.
And right?
Right.
So now that we make a real big point of doing that, and so sort of figuring that if that is no problem for her, then probably we're okay. But it certainly was true, I think, with a few women that once that they might have suddenly heard through the grapevine or something that we were all lesbian feminist separatists or something, and suddenly said, wait a minute. And that has happened, and I don't think it will happen as much anymore.
Anything else?
No.
No, if any woman who listens to this program has $10,000, tell her to write me.
Really?